This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What are the coming decades about? Did you picture a nomad century? Award-winning science journalist, broadcaster, and author Gaia Vince does. In a book stuffed with science and investigation, Gaia says warming and climate disruption will force at least 1 billion humans to find new homes. They are already on the move. Is it futile to resist? Gaia Vince is published by the BBC, The Guardian, New Scientist, and more. She produces science documentaries for radio and television. Her book, Adventures in the Anthropocene, won the Royal Society Prize for Science Books. And now we have the new one, Nomad Century, How to Survive the Climate Upheaval. From the UK, Gaia Vince, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to join you.
What brought you to this vision of vast numbers of humans on the move?
I've been following climate change for over a decade now, in fact, environmental change generally. And as part of my research, looking at this, I've travelled widely around the world, mainly the global south. And I've already seen with my own eyes quite a lot of climate migration, whether it's villages in the Andes that have had to leave and move to the cities, move to Lima or La Paz, because their villages have been experiencing drought year after year after year, and their livelihoods have gone in terms of their agricultural livelihoods. Glaciers that have previously fed their fields have melted and disappeared. And there are these enlarging slum housing, I guess, shanty towns built around cities from Dhaka in Bangladesh to Mumbai to Lima, you know, all across the world of people who have been forced to move. And I've also seen it in the rich world. You know, I'm half Australian, so I've seen my own family members and friends have to move because of bushfires across Australia or terrible floods that have made them homeless and then living in temporary housing or they've had to just completely relocate. And I've also got friends in the US that have had to move because of fire or flood. So it's not a problem that is limited only to poorer countries. It is happening everywhere. But what we're going to see is this vast wave across the tropics where in the coming decades, conditions will simply be too extreme for people. And that's where the majority of the migration is going to be coming from.
There has been a huge heat wave recently across Asia. Just last week, 11 people at a festival outside Mumbai, India, suffered heat strokes.
I mean, it's appalling, and schools have been closed. Buenos Aires has just come out of a heat wave. Europe, there have been forest fires on the border of France and Spain in March, you know, and this is the Northern Hemisphere where we don't expect spring conditions to have ended until, you know, at least May.
So in your research, what parts of the world are likely to become uninhabitable if the world warms to 3 degrees and beyond?
Well, so at the moment, if you look at just one metric, if you look at heat, at the moment, about 1% of the Earth's land surface is classed as uninhabitable due to heat. But by 2070, we expect some 20% of the Earth's land surface to be uninhabitable due to heat. And that is home currently to about a third of the world's population. So, you know, we're currently home to about 8 billion people. After mid-century, we will be looking at 9, perhaps as much as 10 billion. So we're looking at about 3 billion people living in places that are likely to be uninhabitable due to heat. But heat is just one of the problems, one of what I call the four horsemen of the Anthropocene. So it's heat, fire, flood and drought. These are the extreme conditions that affect. They really impact livability. They hurt property, infrastructure. They can ruin livelihoods, and they can be fatal for people. So we're seeing when we look at the models of the planet as we heat over the century, we're going to see this swayed around the tropics. So it goes as far south as Australia and Patagonia across the whole of the African continent and up in the US, up as near to the Great Lakes, in Europe, up certainly into Spain and southern France and across the very populated places of Asia, the whole of most of India and China. And we're also, of course, coastlines are going to be affected by coastal erosion, much greater storm surges. We're going to see river deltas, the homes of some of the world's most populous, biggest cities, all affected. But there is nowhere on Earth that is going to be unaffected by these conditions. You know, everyone is going to have some effects. But further north, the far north, those latitudes are going to be experiencing lesser impacts. That are more adaptable. So we will all have to adapt to the new conditions. We need to start adapting now, and it will be much more possible in the far north.
And then in the future, you predict cities in the cooler global north will compete to attract migrants, and that runs against all the rhetoric we hear these days. Why would this happen?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? The narrative around migration has grown so toxic that a lot of nations are, you know, they're imposing all sorts of border restrictions to keep people out. But that's actually relatively recent. Until just very recent decades, most countries were more concerned with trying to keep people in and try and attract more people. You know, there were all sorts of schemes to get post-war, to get people from the former colonies and empire of European nations to come and help rebuild after the war. Australia had a system of called £10 POMs to try and encourage people over. The United States was also trying to encourage people to come. And that's been the case throughout history, really, because economic productivity really depends on increasing that labor force. And as we move through the century, what we are seeing is already this demographic crisis really hitting certainly Europe, but also many other countries, from Japan to China to the United States, where people are simply not having enough babies to support an aging population. That puts huge strain on the economies of these nations. And the way to solve that labor problem is through immigration. So we are going to have to see a shift. And you can already see, you know, even the most populist governments who, with one hand, are turning back people, they're putting up walls, they're sending people to Rwanda or whatever the latest policy is. With the other hand, they're trying desperately to bring people in because there are labour shortages in everything from hospitality to healthcare to truck drivers to farm labour. I mean, really across the board, people are needed. And more flexible borders for movements of labour just increase the economy. I mean, some economists think that if we took away all borders completely, the global economy would at least double, if not treble, overnight.
But if you go before the public, or a politician does, saying we need open borders, you risk being shouted down. It seems impossible open borders will be welcomed by any developed country in the future. Who agrees with you?
I'm not necessarily calling for open borders, but I am calling for a completely different attitude and different policy or different way of managing our borders and migration patterns. Because, you know, some nations are already well aware of that. If you look at Canada, Canada has plans to treble its population over the coming decades, you know, and it has a very different policy. But what we have had over recent decades has been this very pervasive, very strong anti-migrant narrative, this very nationalistic narrative across many nations, and it hasn't been countered. But it's perfectly possible to counter that and to change people's attitudes and to explain and extol the very many evidence-based ways that migration, that immigration actually improves economies, improves societies, and can really help with many of the huge challenges that we face over the coming decades. I mean, people are coming whether we like it or not. So it's much better to have policies that work with that reality and try and manage what's coming rather than pretending that making announcements that we're going to, you know, get immigration numbers down or expel loads of people when it's just not going to happen. So, you know, that we've tried that. Many governments have tried that and it doesn't work. But when you say that people won't like immigration, greater immigration, well, you know, I would challenge that actually, because despite this very strong, pervasive anti-migrant narrative led by politicians and trumpeted by many of the of the media, we have got evidence through many surveys that the general population is not nearly as xenophobic as governments would like. I mean, if you take my country, Britain, we've just had, well, not just anymore, but we've had a very, very toxic Brexit debate driven largely on the back of this issue of immigration and this notion of, I guess, Britain for Britons. But despite that, if you look at any of the surveys, people are actually more positive about immigration than they were before. They are year on year becoming much more positive and much more pro all sorts of migrant and immigration questions when they're asked, for instance, should immigrants be treated second class when it comes to job allocation? The answer is no for pretty much everyone. Do you think we need to reduce immigration? The answer is no. Do you think we should increase immigration? The answer is yes. For the majority polled across the country. Now, you wouldn't know that if you looked at our actual official government policy, which is more and more draconian every month on immigration. But the actual population is far less xenophobic. And I think governments need to be a bit more aware of that and be a bit braver. There's a lot of timidity among leaders of all parties and even broaching the subject of immigration because people are so nervous about being unpopular. But the evidence shows that if you explain people movement and labour movement in a more positive way, you know, it doesn't have to be that way.
Yes, I remember in 2008, British scientist and inventor James Lovelock shocked many when he said Britain will become a life raft. Those were his words for climate refugees. He said the UK should start building schools and hospitals now to be ready for the influx. Gaia Vince, what do you think?
I didn't know that. I mean, it's very prescient. He was a very, very wise man. I met him a few times, and that's absolutely true. You know, Britain happens to be, certainly the north, the southeast is going to be and is already being very heavily affected by drought. We've already experienced some terrible heat waves and floods in other places. But the north, if you look at Scotland, for example, sea level rise will not be a problem because Scotland is still rebounding from the last ice age. After being pressed down so heavily by ice sheets, it's still rising and it's rising faster than sea level is rising. It's actually going to be one of the beneficiaries of many of the climate impacts. It's going to have longer growing seasons. Heating bills won't be so much during the winter time. So there are places in the north which are much more able and will be much more livable into the coming decades. They will be the strategic centres, you know, as we go through this very challenging century of upheaval.
You point out humans are fleeing from the Holocene environment that we evolved into, willy-nilly into a hotter, more extreme Anthropocene age. Then comes a remarkable claim, quote, "We are all finding our feet in the Anthropocene, and no one has better claim than anyone else to the habitable 21st century landscapes," end quote. Do you mean I have no claim to my homeland of Canada?
Well, you know, what do you base that on? What do you base your claim on? I think we need to start genuinely rethinking this. You know, we are a mammal species. We're a tropical ape that has dispersed over a couple of hundred thousand years across, well, actually the dispersal was much more recent, across the entire planet. You know, we gain our rights to our square footage of land through accident of birth. And I think that when we collectively, as humanity, and it isn't entirely collectively, of course. It's the richer countries have had much more of a role than poorer countries. But when we collectively make parts of our planet uninhabitable, we must also collectively use the habitable bits to accommodate the rest of our species. You know, we work as a network. The only reason that you can be sedentary in your little space in Canada or that I can be fairly sedentary in my few meters of London is because everything that I need, everything I eat, all the resources, all the things, all my culture, everything is brought to me, and it's brought to me collectively from around the globe. You know, I have potatoes from Peru for lunch. I have beans from Syria. Everything I have, everything I own has come through this network of humanity from across the globe, and by strangers who themselves are moving around. They are doing the migration, and the secondary migrations of our staff have carried them all there. So I don't think that I can claim really any more right to a habitable land than anyone else. We need to stop this, what I think really is a sort of almost a narcissistic entitlement to a space and to a lifestyle and livelihood which, you know, we need to consider the rest of humanity, because we don't exist alone. We don't do anything alone. We are part of a human ecosystem, and we are part of a biosphere. We're part of a planetary ecosystem, and we rely on that. So cutting our own nose off to spite our face is foolish, of course, but also humanity is a collective pursuit, and we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility for people that we don't know, that are far away, but also for where they can live, for what they can drink. You know, I think the last COP that was held in November, there was a recognition that rich countries should pay poor countries for the losses and damages they've experienced and they are experiencing and will experience for climate change. Well, part of that loss and damage includes the very land that they live on and what they call home and how they make their food and their living. And, you know, if that disappears, well, we have a responsibility as a humanity, as a species, to help provide that for them elsewhere.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio Ecoshock. I'm Alex Smith from the UK. Our guest is author and broadcaster Gaia Vince. We are talking about her book, Nomad Century, How to Survive the Climate Upheaval. You write about Spain and saying that from 2000 to 2009, they added 6 million immigrants, and yet we haven't seen much about anti-immigrant protests or politics in Spain. Why not?
I think there's been some really interesting experiments in different countries. You know, everybody is trying different ways to deal with this issue of human movements and how to accommodate them. And there are parts of Spain that have tried, you know, really hard new ways, new types of inclusivity. And I write in my book about Parla, which is a suburb, I suppose, of Madrid. It's outside Madrid, where they decided to take a new tactic with immigration, and they granted full citizenship. They really helped with inclusivity. They built housing that was decent and that was near to facilities with improved transport links, so people had ways and means. You know, if you help people to help themselves, if you give them the agency, if you give them the legal ability to work, and the agency to have citizenship and enough money that they can then form their own networks and they can become their own type of entrepreneur. These people repay the state far more than the initial input through taxes, through the education of their children, through all the services and social benefits and cultural benefits that new citizens bring. And what was found there is this, because these people had self-respect as citizens. They felt themselves to be Spanish, and the existing Spanish population regarded them and treated them as new Spanish people. So they were not sort of segregated into ghettos of migrants, which happens frequently in other cities, where immigrants are sort of all housed in a block on the outskirts, and it's really degraded, and they're not allowed to work, and they're not, you know, they're given an absolutely tiny stipend, and it's very impoverishing. These people felt like they felt Spanish. They felt like citizens. And when the economic crisis hit, while other immigrant areas in France and Germany and other places experienced a lot of unrest among migrant populations who experienced incredible poverty at the time, the ones in Parla in Spain did not. They did not. They also experienced poverty, but they got through it without protest and without conflict with there wasn't this rise of racism. There wasn't this rise of conflict at all within the society. It held together and they helped each other. And I think that is really a lesson. Social, when we talk about immigration working and being managed, we need to talk about, first of all, the need for financial investment, ensuring that people do have access to housing, to infrastructure, to health and education services and everything that that people need as citizens. And that's, that's a problem when many governments are failing to provide that for their existing population. This is a policy failure. That's what's happening. So that initial financial investment needs to be made. But just as important is the social investment, that investment in true inclusivity that accepts that people coming are not lesser, they're not aliens, they are new citizens, they are part of the city of tomorrow. They are, their children and your children are the generation that makes up the future of your country. And I think that what we're often talking about, really, the elephant in the room is challenging racism, because many of the people coming are coming from tropical countries where they have more melanated skin than many of host populations in the northern hemisphere, far north especially. So we're talking about more darker skinned people moving into more homogeneously white skinned areas, and there is this very uncomfortable ethno-nationalism that's been building over recent years, which is this narrative that there is a pure, I don't know, Swede or a pure German or a pure whatever Czech person. And this is rubbish. Every single population genetic study shows that we are completely mixed up. We are from everywhere. We were until very recently migrants, and you can see that we were all migrants. You can see that in our DNA. There isn't any pure ethnically pure race that really belongs to a place. That's just not true biologically, and we need to challenge that.
We're going to need international planning. Does the United Nations have a plan for this mass migration under climate change?
Well, I mean, there has been, just in the last few months, movements towards, there is this kind of compact on migration, which was an attempt to look at this in 2018, but it's not legally binding. Many countries either refused to sign or abstained. They either objected or abstained to signing this compact. So it's very much kind of an intention to start thinking about it and maybe do something at some point in the future. But, this can't wait. We really do need something. We need, I think, a new UN agency, but with teeth to actually act, because we have a completely broken immigration system globally, and it is a global issue, because people are moving not just within nations, but across borders and across regions. And at the moment, much of this is very dangerous. It's not at all facilitated, and because of the danger, huge sums are being paid to all sorts of criminal gangs. People are dying needlessly, and they're also being held in, refugee camps or in some sort of enclosure. I mean, they're basically prisons. They can't get on with their lives. They're not, this is not a way to help host societies or countries of origin or the migrants themselves. Everybody loses in this game, and we could do so much better. People move to where there's work. That's where they're trying to move, unless they are fleeing instantly an extreme catastrophe, an evacuation scenario. Most people are migrating in search of a better life, in search of work, and they're migrating to where the work is. There is a need for this labour. And, you know, we're not matching these at all. So it damages economies, it damages societies, and it damages families, people.
It seems absurd you and I are talking about displacement, possibly of billions of people due to human-made global heating, which we could have avoided. But here we are. Are you finding many people ready for this conversation?
Well, it's interesting. I've had a sort of mixed reaction. Some people don't want to talk about it. They don't want to talk or even think about the climate emergency that we're facing, this catastrophe where, we're talking about parts of the world, significant parts of the world, home to most of the world's population, being unlivable for months of the year within a few decades. I mean, this is really serious. You know, there are parts of the world that are already increasingly unlivable. Farmers are working at night with head torches because they can't go out during the day. That is not a life. But, you know, people are going to be fleeing. And so the responses have been kind of stick my fingers in my ears and cover my eyes, you know, or hostility to the idea of migration and to the idea of climate change. But that is, I have to say, as far as I'm aware, a very small minority view, actually. The majority of people are relieved someone is actually talking about this now, because this really is, it is a growing crisis in the making. You know, we know about climate change. We know that, you know, countries are on fire, they're flooded. I mean, the Miami newspapers last week were leading with huge stories about the floods taking over the cities, and yet people are still investing there. We need to wake up to the reality.
Gaia Vince, what are you working on next?
Oh, well, this is for me a very important issue, looking at the ecological change that we're experiencing and sort of documenting it. So I'm working on a book about to try and explain our place in the biosphere for children. I'm trying to get my head around making people understand, or trying to help people understand what we're facing and understand myself as well, because it's conceptually difficult what we're going through. It is an enormous upheaval this century, and it's something that, you know, humans haven't really experienced before.
Where are the best places for listeners to keep up with your work?
Well, I'm on Twitter briefly until that becomes impossible. So I have a website, wanderinggaia.com, and on Twitter, I'm wanderinggaia.
Check out that site. From the UK, we've been speaking with author and broadcaster Gaia Vince about her book, Nomad Century, How to Survive the Climate Upheaval. You can find out more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Gaia, thank you for sharing your time and your vision with our listeners.
Well, it's my great pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Coming up, is your bank funding a wrecked climate for you and your family? Probably. April Merlot is next.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.